Well, let's see if we can get into the topic today, and that is 2 Corinthians 11. But I thought what I would do is, before we get into actually the message, use a story that I think relates very well to some of the things that we will be looking at, and that is we'll be looking at today, for example, how certainly Jesus Christ changes a life, but also the story of Louis Zamperini is a story of an individual who, as a non-Christian, suffered so many trials and persecution, beatings, and the rest, and we'll be reading today about what the Apostle Paul faced as a Christian in that regard. I thought I'd read this from a book that I did an interview on this week. It says that the story, and his real name is Louis, but everybody called him Louis, Louis Zamperini, remained relatively obscure for decades until Laura Hildebrand happened on a newspaper article about him. Hildebrand made a habit of reading old newspaper articles in order to glean facts and information for her work. As she was perusing a vintage newspaper, she noticed an article about a man named Louis Zamperini and his running proneness. She became fascinated with him, and she wondered what had happened to him since his running days. And that is an actual picture of him there on the left when he ran for USC as he was preparing to actually run in the Olympics, which were supposed to be in Tokyo, but those were, as we know, canceled. And so, by the way, it's kind of interesting. If you're not familiar, Laura Hildebrand is an incredible woman as well. By the age of 19, she had chronic fatigue so bad that she had to drop out of college. Her parents, not understanding that, assumed that she was lazy and separated from her. So she went through all this pain in her own life. When she wrote the book that's probably before this, the best known book that she wrote, which was called Seabiscuit, which later became a movie, she wrote it on her back with her eyes closed, writing it, you know, a little bit day by day in order to produce that. Bob Seifer later on said, you know, your story, Laura, is a story that parallels the story of Louis Zamperini. But anyway, let's go on and talk about this. Anyway, she, of course, met Zamperini, was convinced that his story needed to be told, and, of course, wrote the book called Unbroken, which, of course, is a movie. It debuted number 2 on the New York Times bestseller list, was on that list for 4 years. The book chronicles, of course, his life from his running days to his post-war life. Zamperini was on his way to an Olympic medal in running. Unfortunately for him, the Olympics slated for Tokyo had to be canceled because war had broken out. More unfortunately for him, Zamperini was drafted in the war and shot down at sea. And if you've ever seen the movie, you know that there he's in this raft 47 days fighting for his life in the sea until he is kind of rescued, if you will, by the Japanese. And now begins the series of abuses. It is hard to see the film or even to read the book because there are places where he is beaten. There's a place where all the prisoners are to punch him in the face. There's, of course, that famous scene where he's holding this timber and the man says, if he drops it, shoot him, you know. And so he went through a great deal. And equally beyond belief is the fact that he lived to tell about it. But the war took its toll on Zamperini. By the time he returned home, he was emotionally and physically spent. He was plagued by nightmares of his captors. The torture he was forced to endure did not end when he returned home. It merely changed location from his body to his mind. His days and nights were filled with the mental torture of his memories. He sought to dispel his demons through alcohol. By the way, that second picture is from Unbroken, and you see how accurate the actor looks, just like he actually did when he was growing up and when he was running. Louis's wife was deeply depressed over his post-war condition. She noticed at one point that Billy Graham was coming to town. She determined to find a way to coax Louis into going with her to hear Graham. Reluctantly, Louis went along. He listened as Graham began to preach from the Gospel of John, chapter 8. Inside himself, Louis felt something twisting. Darkness doesn't hide the eyes of God, Graham said. God takes your life from the time you were born to the time you die. And when you stand before God on the great judgment day, you're going to say, Lord, I wasn't such a bad fellow. Then go through some of the other parts of the preaching of Billy Graham. But let me go on to the final conclusion. And this was not good news to Louis. He knew deep down that if God was to number all of Louis's faults and sins, he would fail miserably. He would be unable to pass the test. And today, Pastor Graham was giving us a test, wasn't he? Six different tests that we can apply. Louis felt indignant rage flaring in him, a struck match. I'm a good man, he thought. I'm a good man. Even though as he thought this thought, he felt the lie in it. Louis had heard all he wanted to hear that night. He returned home to the nightmares and mental torture that had become so familiar to him. Louis's wife, Cynthia, urged him to come with her again the next night. Louis refused. He had heard enough. But Cynthia persisted, so Louis agreed to go on one condition. As soon as Graham would call his audience to bow their heads and pray, they would leave. When Graham finished preaching that night, Louis grabbed Cynthia and they headed for the gate. Suddenly, another disturbing memory came to mind. He was a body on a raft, dying of thirst. He felt words whispered from his swollen lips. It was a promise thrown at heaven, a promise he had not kept, a promise he had allowed himself to forget until just this moment. What was that? His promise was, if you will let me live, if you will save me, I will serve you forever. And there, standing under a circus tent on a clear night in downtown Los Angeles, Louis felt rain falling down. It was the last flashback he would ever have. Louis let go of Cynthia and turned towards Graham. He felt supremely alive. He began walking. This is it, Graham said. God has spoken to you. You come on. And from that day until Louis's death in 2014, his life was never the same. He was a changed man. The nightmares were gone for good, alcohol no longer appealing, and Louis lived out the next 5 decades in service to the Lord who had changed him. The story of Louis Zamperini is dramatic in almost every way. A superior athlete robbed of his chance for glory. A war hero robbed of his humanity. A war veteran robbed of his sanity. But then he was changed. He heard the good news of the gospel. He trusted in the Lord Jesus Christ. And everything he once paled into insignificance compared to what he had become. He was a new man. There's a picture of him at that crusade, which I was able to find, and then a picture of him and Dr. Graham before he died. And what an incredible story of that. Not only a story of an incredibly changed life, from an alcoholic tortured by nightmares to an individual who never touched a drink again and never had another flashback or nightmare. And if nothing else, illustrates again one of the verses I was going to mention, that Pastor Graham mentioned, 2 Corinthians 5, verse 17. We become what? A new creation. And also an individual that suffered tremendously in terms of what he faced as a non-believer. But now we're going to see some of the things that the Apostle Paul faced as a believer. We're going to see, first of all, that he's going to once again come back to this theme of boasting and of his accomplishments, and follows kind of this foolish idea of actually talking about all the things that would be on his resume. And then at the end of what's called the fool's speech, I had a list of his accomplishments. He now turns the idea of boasting on its head and instead elevates the fact that it's the hallmark of what Christ has done in your life. And I thought Louis Zamperini gives us a great illustration of that. Turn with me, if you would, to 2 Corinthians chapter 11. We'll look at the first 15 verses. Here Paul says, I wish you would bear with me in a little foolishness. Do bear with me, for I feel a divine jealousy for you, since I betrothed you to one husband to present you as a pure virgin to Christ. But I am afraid that as the serpent deceived Eve by his cunning, your thoughts will be led astray from a sincere and pure devotion to Christ. For if someone comes and proclaims another Jesus than the one we proclaim, or if you receive a different spirit than the one you received, or if you accept a different gospel from the one you accepted, you put up with it readily enough. Indeed, I consider that I am not in the least inferior to these super apostles. Those would be the false apostles we're talking about in just a minute. Even if I am unskilled in speaking, I am not so in knowledge. Indeed, in every way we have made this plain to you and in all things. Or did I commit a sin in humbling myself so that you might be exalted because I preach God's gospel to you free of charge? I robbed other churches by accepting support from them in order to serve you, and when I was with you, I was in need. I did not burden anyone, for the brothers who came from Macedonia supplied my need. So I refrained and will refrain from burdening you in any way. As the truth of Christ is in me, this boasting of mine will not be silenced in the regions of Achaia. And why? Because I do not love you. God knows that I do. And what I do, I will continue to do in order to undermine the claim of those who would like to claim that in their boasted mission, they work on the same terms as we do. For such men are false apostles, deceitful workmen, disguising themselves as apostles of Christ. And no wonder, for even Satan disguises himself as an angel of light, so it is no surprise if his servants also disguise themselves as servants of righteousness. Their end will correspond to their deeds. And here Paul talks about a number of issues that he's beginning to finish off with in his last letter to the church in Corinth. He engages in some boasting, if nothing else, to gain an ear. They've been used to individuals lauding their own boasting, lauding their own resume, their own accomplishments. But he is somewhat reluctant to do that, so that's why he says, bear with me as I play the fool so that I can expose the foolishness of these other individuals. So in doing that, you might want to put down in your notes Proverbs 26 verse 5. I thought this is a good example that sometimes you have to answer a fool according to his folly. And here we begin to see that he's spending some time here talking about what many people have referred to as the fool's speech. He begins to talk about some of his credentials. We'll look at more of that in just a minute. But his appeal for them is for them to pay attention to what he's saying for three different reasons. Reason number one is that he is, if nothing else, an individual that has godly jealousy and paternal jealousy for them. Since their conversion, the Corinthians were betrothed to Christ. And so I kind of use the illustration, he's kind of like the father of the bride. If you've ever been through a wedding, you know, he's obviously the one that has actually betrothed them to Christ. So it's like the father of the bride. He's wanting to recognize how much he is concerned for them. Number two, he also has a fear for their deception. All the way through these passages, he's talking about that. And of course, we see the famous passage there about Satan disguising himself as an angel of light. For many years, we've had people have out-of-body experiences, and they say, we saw this bright light. It has to be God. Not necessarily, right? You know, you might see a being of light, but it could be Satan. And here, he's using this idea that these individuals that you actually respect, these individuals you're listening to and following, they could be messengers of unrighteousness. They could be pawns of Satan. So certainly, if nothing else, I want to speak to you because I'm concerned about the fact that you might be deceived. And then thirdly, he's of course talking about this because of his authority. He is an apostle, and because he's an apostle, he has credentials, and so they should pay attention to what he is actually saying. Then his final justification is the fact that, you know, I gave you a ministry of no charge. You know, while I collected resources and received resources from those who took up collections in Macedonia, Corinthian church, I've never asked you for a penny. I've never asked you to support my ministry. And so, again, one of the things that he's trying to answer is that some were saying, well, he must not be an apostle because he's not charging for that, which is kind of interesting. You know, they were paying for false teachers. They weren't paying for true gospel. And so he's even kind of taking on that issue as well. And so he distinguishes himself from these other false apostles because he really labored with his own hands. If you're taking some notes, you might put down 1 Corinthians 4:12, because there is a sense in which we see Paul in his earlier letter to the church in Corinth, the fact that he was able to work with his own hands. In most cases, we believe that he was a tent maker. He may have been involved in other activities as well. And he received, as I mentioned, some benefit and some financial support from those from Macedonia. And then he did not, of course, have this as a sign of lack of love. In other words, he didn't ask for money because he didn't think that they would love him or that he would love them, but rather as a way in which he's trying to refuse support in some of these other letters. I put down a couple of the verses where that shows up. And this is, again, to distinguish himself from some of these others who charge for the speaking that they do, even though they were teaching a false gospel. He is not going to charge them for teaching the true gospel. And so I think, if nothing else, it really kind of serves as a real warning for some of us. While he hates to engage in any kind of self-obsessive practice, He eventually does it, if nothing else, out of the love for the church in Corinth. And if only they would have ears to hear, they'd be aware of some of the dangers of accepting a different gospel. And so I think, if nothing else, the application point here is let us also have ears to identify false teaching. And as you see in your handout, in just a minute, if we have time, I want to talk about some of the various criteria for a false teacher that comes not from Paul, although Paul has given us some, but from Peter, and to see again how we would begin to think about those individuals that would be false teachers in our day, just as there were false teachers in that day. Let's finish off the section here, and we'll start now in verse 16. And here Paul says, "I repeat, let no one think me foolish, but even if you do, accept me as a fool, so that I may too boast a little. What I'm saying with this boastful confidence, I say not with the Lord's authority, but as a fool. Since many boast according to the flesh, I too will boast. For you gladly bear with fools, being wise yourselves. For you bear it if someone makes slaves of you, or devours you, or takes advantage of you, or puts on airs, or strikes you in the face." This incredible line there. "To my shame, I must say, we were too weak for that. For whatever anyone else dares to boast of, I am speaking as a fool, I also dare to boast of that. Are they Hebrews? So am I. Are they Israelites? So am I. Are they offsprings of Abraham? So am I. Are they servants of Christ? I am a better one. I am talking like a madman," he says, "with far greater labors, far more imprisonments, with countless beatings, and often near death." Now he gives us quite a list, some of which are recorded in the book of Acts. Others we find out, if you will, for the first time in this list. And Paul says, "Five times I received at the hands of the Jews the 40 lashes, lest one. Three times I was beaten with rods. Once I was stoned. Three times I was shipwrecked. A night and a day I was adrift at sea, on frequent journeys, in danger of rivers, danger from robbers, danger from my own people, danger from Gentiles, danger in the city, danger in the wilderness, danger at sea, danger from false brothers, in toil and hardship, through many a sleepless night, in hunger and thirst, often without food, in cold and exposure. And apart from other things, there is the daily pressure on me of my anxiety for all the churches. Who is weak, and am I not weak? Who is made to fall, and am I not indignant? For if I must boast, I will boast of the things that show my weakness. The God and Father of the Lord Jesus Christ, who is blessed forever, knows that I'm not lying." Then he concludes with something I'll talk about in just a minute. "At Damascus, the governor under King Aretas was guarding the city of Damascus in order to seize me. But I was let down in a basket through a window in the wall and escaped his hands." This is quite a list, isn't it? Any day you think your life has been a little bit difficult, just look at this list. Anytime you even hear about other persecuted Christians, look at what Paul went through there as well. And so he begins a so-called fool's speech with all sorts of accolades and commendations that would be used if indeed he was being introduced before those in the court there in Corinth and to actually give a message. He brags, if you will, about his credentials. He is a Jew. He is a follower of Christ and all sorts of things. He's saying, if you want to have a competition of resumes, mine is much better than anyone else's. And then begins to help us understand what he went through, because while he knows such worldly boasting is really foolish and calls it such, and the opposite of godly, he deems it to be necessary in order to reach some of these fools with the truth. Sometimes you just simply have to come down to their level and use that to communicate. And he actually says at one point, "I feel like I'm a fool. I feel like I'm a madman even talking this way." But nevertheless, that's what he does. And then in verse 30, he begins to explain why his boasting is distinctive from what he has from the false teachers. He's proud of the evidences, not of the strengths, but his weaknesses. And so many times, I know I've prayed, "God, your strength is perfected in my weakness. Last week I didn't have much of a voice, for example. There have been other times when I just haven't been able to figure out what I'm going to say next. And I think you have found that sometimes God's great strength, God's great perfection has been manifested in your weakness. And Paul says the very same thing, that oftentimes the greatest display of God's power comes when we are totally dependent upon Him. And so since his hearers may consider his lengthy and severe list of trials as gross exaggerations, he said, no, I'm not appealing to you on the basis of any kind of lie. And of course, we have the book of Acts that documents so much of what indeed has taken place. Then I think it's kind of interesting, at the end, he has these couple of verses about Damascus. And it almost seems thrown in. He's given the list, and then why at the end do you mention Damascus? Then I found a commentary that really helped me understand that. Think about this. Where was Paul or Saul going when he was going to persecute believers? He was on the road to what? Damascus. So you think about, in some respects, this Elvis illustrates to him more than any place on the planet the conversion that took place. Because here you have Saul, a self-righteous Pharisee, attacking Christians gruesomely, and on his road to Damascus to go and to imprison others and maybe even kill other believers, what happens? The conversion that takes place. In order now that he's in Damascus, now preaching in the place where he was going to be before as Saul, now he's Paul, because of the persecution, now in a weak and fearful moment, he has to be lowered in a basket out a window of the city wall of Damascus. Now here was Saul marching into Damascus, and now Paul, in his weakness, being let down in a basket to escape from that city. Do you get the point? And I never really understood why he puts Damascus in there, but it illustrates perfectly the turning point in his life. For Louis Zamperini, it would be that tent there in Los Angeles for Billy Graham. And for many of us, it may be a very specific place or time of our conversion. But I thought it was just fascinating to see that in some respects, for him, the great turning point in his life was illustrated by the city of Damascus. Before we end and head off for our time together, I thought we would take a chance to look at an application of false teachers. As a matter of fact, at one point I was going to call this the faith test, the vocabulary test. I'm glad I didn't, because somebody else already kind of beat me to that one, if you heard that one today. So what I'm going to do is go to 2 Peter 2. I'll put the verses up here on the screen. And I think Paul has given us some characteristics of false teachers, but now we're going to go to Peter, and he gives us three more characteristics of a false teacher, and let's look at each one of those quickly. The first we find in verse 1, 2 Peter 2, verse 1, and here Peter says, "But false prophets also arose among the people, just as there will also be false teachers among you who will secretly introduce destructive heresies, even denying the master who brought them, bringing swift destruction upon themselves." We could put a whole series of things up there, but let me kind of work through each one of those. Notice the first one. It says that the false teachers secretly bring in heresies. Did we see that in Corinth? Yes, these are people that would come and speak to Christians, and they were saying, we're the true followers of Christ. And so they would secretly introduce heresies. Have we seen this in our day? Yes, we have seen this. The man who is the founder of Children of God, at one point had actually studied at Moody Bible Institute. One of the individuals right now, Bart Ehrman, who actually says that the Bible is unreliable, he's been at the University of North Carolina and been other places as well. He actually studied at places like Moody and Biola, but turned away as well. Today we heard Pastor Graham talk about Eugene Peterson, who gave us the message, but said, you know, I'm not so sure that same-sex marriage isn't a bad thing. As a matter of fact, I think I might even do a wedding for a same-sex couple. So the point I think we need to understand is, just because you're in the church just because you're on Christian radio, just because you're on Christian television, just because your books might even be in a Christian bookstore, doesn't necessarily mean that it's true. So how do we know? Well, like the Bereans, we what? Examine the scriptures daily to see whether it's true. When he talks about secretly bringing in heresies, doesn't mean the teaching is secret, but focuses on how deception takes place. And I would suggest to you that if Peter was concerned about people that were secretly introducing false doctrine in the first century, we should be concerned about people secretly introducing false doctrine in what? The 21st century. So the first part of that is they secretly bring in heresies. Number two, these heresies are described as what? Destructive. You know, it's been kind of this mindset, well, you know, if that person wants to believe that, fine. You know, I just live in kind of theological apartheid. We'll believe one thing, we'll let them believe something else. No, heresies are what? Destructive. Heresies can hurt people. People's lives can be destroyed. Years ago, I taught at Northwest Bible Church, and I had one couple that was in our class, and this couple had actually grown up in this very legalistic cult, and they talked about many times, I would have them share their testimony, of the tremendous harm it did to them, to their families, to the extended family, and everything. So sometimes, just think of people that have been harmed by some of these traditional cults, or even some of these current cults. And so again, we can see the destructive nature of heresies. And then finally, one of the keys to a false teacher is sooner or later they deny the Lord. They deny the master who brought them. And so what Peter's saying is they may look saved, but one of the first kind of warning signs, bing, 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 is if they deny who God is. Victor Paul Wirwill of The Way International wrote a book called Jesus Is Not God. Okay, that was pretty clear. You have others like, you know, Sung Young Moon in the Unification Church, in which they said, well, you know, Jesus maybe saved people spiritually, but he didn't save people physically, so you need me, the Lord of the Second Advent, to continue the salvation. In one way or another, they deny that kind of issue. You probably had Jehovah's Witnesses come to your door, and they'll deny that Jesus was really God. So in one way or another, you have something that catches your attention. And so as a result, we see in verse 1 some of the characteristics of false teachers. Let's look now at verse 2. 2 Peter 2, chapter 2, now verse 2. Many will follow their sensuality, and because of them, the way of the truth will be maligned. And that is, first of all, it said many will follow them. Many will follow them. Just because you have lots of people that come out to a rally, come out to a conference, are members of that church, or they're planting various, if you will, churches or ministries or temples around the world, doesn't necessarily mean that it is true. So just because something works doesn't mean it's true. As a matter of fact, sometimes people say, well, it even works. You know, I've done transcendental meditation, and it's lowered my blood pressure. It's lowered my stress. So it works, so it must be true. Well, it may be working because someone other than God is providing some of that benefit. So that's another aspect. Be careful of assuming that because you have lots of people following an individual, that they're really teaching biblical truth. And then finally, this idea that truth will be maligned. Probably a better translation, some other translations say, the truth will be what? Blasphemed. In other words, it denies biblical truth. And so they'll disgrace God and His honor. And it also talks about this idea of sensuality. You know, the children of God were actually encouraged to go out and get sexually involved with other individuals to attract them into the church. I mentioned Sung Young Moon. He said, you know, after all, Jesus saved people spiritually, but I need to come to save people physically, so I pass on the good seed. And so he would actually have intercourse with the individuals so that they would be saved. I mean, there's a sensual nature to a lot of these cults that you have to wonder, again, what kind of damage might be done as well. Then finally, verse 3, 2 Peter 2, verse 3, and in their greed they will exploit you with false words, and their judgment from long ago is not idle, and their destruction is not asleep. And so the first thing it says is that false teachers would use greed, or some of your translations would say covetousness. So in order to attract individuals, they oftentimes have kind of a prosperity gospel. You know, if you do these things, then you will be successful. And so there's a sense in which there's self-gratification. And so it's really appealing to our sinful nature, and that's why these are so successful. But then the final comment there, their judgment is not idle. They'll be judged for their heresy, if not on this planet, certainly in the life to come. And so again, even though it may seem that they're prospering for a while, and we see many cults around the world that seem to be doing very well, the judgment is coming soon. Before we ran out of time, though, I thought, you know, as we've talked about this in the negative, can we use this in the positive? And my argument is yes, and this will be kind of my concluding slide. And that is, if you think about it, the opposite of these three characteristics provide a good definition of what a biblical teacher should be. Just think about this. What was our first one? Well, they were teaching a truncated gospel. They were teaching a false gospel. So one of the characteristics of a true biblical teacher is he or she teaches the whole counsel of God. That he or she spends time exposing the heresies outside the church and the heresies inside the church. So one characteristic of a biblical teacher is one that teaches every part of the Bible and teaches it with great authority and giving you the tools so that you as well will have discernment. Number two, we recognized that oftentimes these cults might be very popular. So a good biblical teacher is not worried about numbers. Matter of fact, those who are preaching God's word sometimes will find that it could be very unpopular, not only to the believers, but certainly to the watching world. When you preach on the issue of homosexuality right now, you get tagged right off the bat. Matter of fact, I just did a commentary a week or two ago where Guidestone actually labeled any organization as a hate group that was labeled by the Southern Poverty Law Center. Now, they've removed that, at least for a time. But, you know, if you were to go and check out, for example, the Family Research Council or the American Family Association, or sadly, Probe Ministries, it had the hate group label on it. And so, again, you can see that if you stand for biblical truth, very quickly, guess what? You get tagged. You get attacked. And so a godly teacher of God's word will stand for biblical truth even when it might be unpopular. And number three, we saw that those false teachers emphasize greed and materialism and sensuality. And a biblical teacher is a person who is not greedy, and they are not full of greed and do not seek to exploit their followers. So again, I think you have some very good illustrations of how we can begin to think about these false teachers. But if anything, we certainly see once again, Paul was willing to remind us what he went through to stand for the gospel. This week is a reminder that we need to stand true to the gospel and suffer the consequences thereof. Parker?